the stadium. Right there on Lake Erie, bitter winds, ground as hard as concrete. What was your favorite stop? Rick grunted out a laugh and said, stop. That's a good word. I stopped here and there, but never found a place. Dallas, I guess. I prefer warmer weather. The sun was almost gone, and the air was growing cooler. Rick stuck his hands into the pockets of his tight jeans and said, so tell me about football in Italy. How did it happen? The first teams popped up about 20 years ago, and it spread like crazy, mainly here in the north. The Super Bowl in 1990 drew 20,000, a lot less last year. Then it declined for some reason. Now it's growing again. There are 9 teams in the A division, 25 or so in the B division, and flag football for the kids. Another pause as Rick rearranged his hands. The 2 months in Florida had given him a dark tan, but a thin skin. His tan was already fading. How many fans watch the Panthers? Depends. We don't sell tickets, so no one really counts. Maybe 1,000? When Bergamo rolls in, the place is packed. Bergamo? The Bergamo Lions, perennial champs. Rick found this amusing. Lions and Panthers, do they all have NFL names? No, we also have the Bologna Warriors, Rome Gladiators, Naples Bandits, Milan Rhinos, Lazio Marines, as well as the Ancona Dolphins and Bolzano Giants. Rick chuckled at the names. What's so funny? Sam asked. Nothing. Where am I? It's normal. The shock wears off fast, though. Once you put on the gear and start hitting, you'll feel at home. I don't hit, Rick wanted to say, but thought better of it. So, Bergamo is the team to beat? Oh, yes. They've won 8 straight Super Bowls and 61 straight games. The Italian Super Bowl. Can't believe I missed it. A lot of people missed it. On the sports pages, we go last after swimming and motorbiking. The Super Bowl is televised, though, on one of the lesser channels. Because he was still horrified at the thought of his friends learning that he was playing intramural ball in Italy, the prospect of no press and no televised games was quite appealing. Rick was not looking for glory in Parma. Just a small paycheck while he and Arnie waited for a miracle back home. He didn't want anyone to know where he was. How often do we practice? We get the field Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, 8 o'clock at night. These guys have real jobs. What kinds of jobs? Everything. Airline pilot, engineer, several truck drivers, property agent, contractors. One guy owns a cheese shop. Another runs a bar. A dentist. 2 or 3 work in gyms. 2 stonemasons. A couple of auto mechanics. Rick considered this for a while. His thoughts were slow. The shock was wearing off. What type of offense? We keep things basic. Power eye, lots of motion and misdirection. Our quarterback last year couldn't throw, so it really limited our attack. Your quarterback couldn't throw? Well, he could, but not very well. We got a runner? Oh, yes. Slidell Turner. Tough little black kid from Colorado State. Drafted late by the Colts 4 years ago. Got cut. Just too small. How small? 5'8", 180. Too small for the NFL, but perfect for the Panthers. They have trouble catching him here. What the hell is a black kid from Colorado State doing here in Parma, Italy? Playing football. Waiting for the phone call. Same as you. Do I have a receiver? Yes. Fabrizio, one of the Italians. Great set of hands, great feet, great big ego. Thinks he's the greatest Italian footballer of all time. High maintenance, but not a bad boy. Can he catch me? I doubt it. It'll take a lot of practice. Just don't kill him the first day. Rick jumped to his feet and said, I'm cold. Let's make a move. You want to see the team room? Sure, why not? There was a clubhouse just beyond the north end zone, and as they walked toward it, a train roared by, a stone's throw away. Inside, the long, flat building was adorned with dozens of posters advertising the corporate sponsors. Rugby occupied most of it, but the Panthers had a small room packed with lockers and equipment. What do you think? Sam asked. It's a locker room, Rick said. He tried not to make comparisons, but for a moment couldn't help but remember the lavish digs in the newer NFL stadiums. Carpet, wood-paneled lockers big enough for small cars, leather recliners built for linemen, private stalls and a shower room bigger than this. Oh well, he told himself he could endure anything for 5 months. This is yours, Sam said, pointing. Rick walked to his locker, an old metal cage, empty except for a white panther helmet hanging from a hook. He had requested the number 8, and it was stenciled on the back of his helmet. Size 7.5. Slidell Turner's locker was to the right, and the name to the left was Trey Colby. "Who's this?" Rick asked. "Colby is our free safety. Played at Ole Miss. Rooms with Slidell, the only 2 black guys on the team. We have only 3 Americans this year. Last year it was 5, but they changed the rules again." On a table in the center, there were neat stacks of game jerseys and pants. Rick inspected them carefully. "Good stuff," he declared. "Glad you approve. You mentioned dinner. I'm not sure which meal my body needs, but food would be welcome. I have just the place. It's an old trattoria owned by 2 brothers. Carlo runs the kitchen and does the cooking. Nino handles the front and makes sure everyone is well fed. Nino is also your center, and don't be surprised when you meet him. Your center in high school was probably bigger, but he's tough on the field, and his idea of a good time is knocking people around for 2 hours once a week. He's also the offensive translator. You call the plays in English, then Nino does a quick version in Italian. Then you break huddle. As you walk to the line, you pray that Nino got the translation right. Most of the Italians can understand the basics in English, and they're quick to go with their first impulse. Often they don't wait for Nino. On some plays, the entire team breaks in different directions, and you have no idea what's going on. So what do I do? Run like hell. This should be fun. It can be, but these guys take it serious, especially in the heat of the battle. They love to hit, both before the whistle and after. They cuss and fight, then they hug and go drink together. A player by the name of Paolo might join us for dinner. His English is very good, and there might be 1 or 2 others. They're anxious to meet you. Nino will take care of the food and wine, so don't worry with the menu. It will be delicious, trust me. Chapter 6. They drove near the university and parked on one of the endless narrow streets. It was dark now, and packs of students drifted by in noisy conversations. Rick was subdued, so Sam handled the dialogue. A trattoria, by definition, is an unassuming, family-owned place with great local dishes and wines, generous portions, not too expensive. Are you listening to me? Yes. They were walking quickly along a sidewalk. Are you going to feed me or talk me to death? I'm trying to ease you into Italian culture. Just find me a pizza. Where was I? A trattoria? Yes, as opposed to a restaurant, which is usually more elegant and expensive. Then there's the osteria, which traditionally was a dining room in an inn, but now can mean almost anything. And the bar, which we've covered. And the enoteca, which usually doubles as a wine shop and offers snacks and smaller dishes. I think that covers it all. So no one goes hungry in Italy. Are you kidding? A small sign for Cafe Montana hung over the door. Through the front window, they could see a long room with empty tables, all covered with starched and pressed white cloths and adorned with blue plates, linens, and massive wine goblets. "We're a bit early," Sam said. "The place gets busy around 8, but Nino is waiting." "Montana?" Rick said. "Yes, after Joe, the quarterback." "No." "Dead serious. These guys love their football. Carlo played years ago but ruined a knee. Now he just cooks. Legend has it that he holds all kinds of records for personal fouls." They stepped inside, and whatever Carlo was preparing back in the kitchen hit them hard. The aroma of garlic and rich meat sauces and frying pork hung like smoke over the front room, and Rick was ready to eat. A fire was burning in a wall pit halfway back. From a side door, Nino bounded into the room and began kissing Sam. A mighty embrace, then a manly, noisy peck somewhere near the right cheek. Same for the left. Then he grabbed Rick's right hand with both of his and said, "Rick, my quarterback, welcome to Parma." Rick shook hands firmly, but was prepared to step backward if the kissing continued. It did not. The accent was thick, but the words were clear. Rick was more like Rick. "My pleasure," Rick said.
"I am center," Nino announced proudly. "But be careful with your hands. My wife, she's jealous."
At which Nino and Sam doubled over in hoarse laughter, and Rick awkwardly followed suit. Nino was less than 6 feet tall, thick and fit, probably around 210 pounds. As he laughed at his own humor, Rick quickly sized him up and realized it could be a very long season. A 5'10" center? Nor was he a youngster. Nino had wavy dark hair with the first shades of gray at the temples. He was in his mid-30s, but there was a strong chin and a definite glow of wildness, a man who loved to brawl. "I'll have to scramble for my life," Rick thought to himself. Carlo rumbled in from the kitchen in his starched white apron and chef's hat. Now here is the center. 6'2", at least 250 pounds, broad shoulders, but a slight limp. He greeted Rick warmly, a quick embrace, no kissing. His English was far below Nino's, and after a few words he ditched it and switched to Italian, leaving Rick to tread water. Sam was quick to step in. He says welcome to Parma and to their restaurant. They have never been so excited to have a real American Super Bowl hero playing for the Panthers, and he hopes you will eat and drink many times at their little cafe. Thank you, Rick said to Carlo. Their hands were still entangled. Carlo resumed his chatter, and Sam was ready. He says the owner of the team is his friend and often eats at Cafe Montana, and that all of Parma is thrilled to have the great Rick Dockery wearing the black and silver. Pause. Rick said thanks again, smiled as warmly as possible, and repeated to himself the words Super Bowl. Carlo finally released him and began yelling at the kitchen. As Nino led them to their table, Rick whispered to Sam, Super Bowl? Where did that come from? I don't know, maybe I didn't get the translation right. Great, you said you're fluent. Most of the time. All of Parma? The great Rick Dockery? What have you been telling these people? The Italians exaggerate everything. Their table was near the fireplace. Nino and Carlo both pulled out chairs for their guests, and before Rick settled into his seat, three young waiters in perfect whites descended upon them. One had a large platter of food. One had a magnum of sparkling wine. One had a basket of breads and two bottles, olive oil and vinegar. Nino snapped his fingers and pointed, and Carlo barked at one of the waiters, who returned fire, and off they went to the kitchen, arguing every step of the way. Rick stared at the platter. In the center was a large chunk of straw-colored hard cheese, and surrounding it in precise loops were what appeared to be cold cuts. Deep, rich, cured meats, unlike anything Rick had ever seen. As Sam and Nino chattered in Italian, a waiter quickly uncorked the wine and filled three glasses. He then stood at attention, starched towel over his arm. Nino passed around the glasses, then held his high.
A toast to the great Rick Dockery and to a Super Bowl win for the Parma Panthers.
Sam and Rick took a sip while Nino drained half of his.
Is Malvasia Secco, he said. From a winemaker close by, everything tonight is from Emilia. The olive oil, the balsamic vinegar wine, and food, everything from right here, he said, proudly thumping his chest with an impressive fist. The best food in the world.
Sam leaned over. This is the Parma province of Emilia-Romagna, one of the regions. Rick nodded and took another sip. On the flight over, he had flipped through a guidebook and knew where he was, sort of. There are 20 regions in Italy, and according to his quick review, almost all claim to have the greatest food and wine in the country. Now for the food. Nino took another gulp, then leaned in, all 10 fingertips touching, the professor set to deliver a lecture he'd given many times. With a casual wave at the cheese, he said,
Of course you know the greatest cheese of all, Parmigiano Reggiano. You say Parmesan, the king of cheese, and made right here. Only real Parmigiano comes from our little town. This one is made by my uncle, 4 kilometers from where you are sitting. The best.
He kissed the tips of his fingers, then gracefully shaved off a few slices, leaving them on the platter as the lecture continued.
Next, he said, pointing to the first loop, is the world-famous prosciutto. You say Parma ham, made only here from special pigs raised on barley and oats and the milk left over from making the Parmigiano. Ad prosciutto is never cooked, he said, gravely wagging a finger for a second in disapproval. But cured with salt, fresh air, and lots of love. 18 months it's cured.
He deftly took a small slice of brown bread, dipped it in olive oil, then layered it with a slice of prosciutto and a shaving of Parmigiano. When it was perfect, he handed it to Rick and said,
A little sandwich.
Rick took it in one large bite, then closed his eyes and savored the moment. For someone who still enjoyed McDonald's, The tastes were astounding. The flavors coated every taste bud in his mouth and made him chew as slowly as possible. Sam was slicing more for himself, and Nino was pouring wine.
"Is good?" Nino asked Rick.
"Oh, yes." Nino thrust another bite at his quarterback, then continued, pointing.
"And then we have culatello from the pig's leg, pulled off the bone, only the best part, then covered in salt, white wine, garlic, lots of herbs, and rubbed by hand for many hours before stuffed into a pig's bladder and cured for 14 months. The summer air dries it, the wet winters keep it tender."
As he spoke, both hands were in constant motion, pointing, drinking, slicing more cheese, carefully mixing the balsamic vinegar into the bowl of olive oil.
"These are the best pigs for the culatello," he said, with another frown. "Small black pigs with a few red patches, carefully selected and fed only natural foods. Never locked up, no. These pigs roam free and eat acorns and chestnuts."
He referred to the creatures with such deference, it was difficult to believe they were about to eat one. Rick was craving a bite of culatello, a meat he'd never before encountered. Finally, with a pause in the narrative, Nino handed over another small slice of bread, layered with a thick round of culatello and topped with Parmigiano.
"Is good?"
he asked as Rick chomped away and held his hand out for more. The wine glasses were refilled.
"The olive oil is from a farm just down the road," Nino was saying, "and the balsamic vinegar is from Modena, 40 kilometers to the east, home of Pavarotti, you know. The best balsamic vinegar comes from Modena, but we have better food in Parma."
The final loop, at the edge of the platter, was Felino salami, made practically on the premises, aged for 12 months, and without a doubt, the best salami in all of Italy. After serving it to Sam and Rick, Nino suddenly dashed to the front, where others were arriving. Finally alone, Rick took a knife and began carving off huge chunks of the Parmigiano. He covered his plate with the meats, cheese, and breads, and ate like a refugee.
"Might want to pace yourself," Sam cautioned. "This is just the antipasto, the warm-up."
"Hell of a warm-up.
Are you in shape?"
"More or less. I'm at 225, about 10 over. I'll burn it off."
"Not tonight, you won't."
Two large young men, Paolo and Giorgio, joined them. Nino presented them to their quarterback while insulting them in Italian, and when all the embracing and greetings were out of the way, they plunked down and stared at the antipasto. Sam explained that they were linemen who could play both sides of the ball if necessary. Rick was encouraged because they were in their mid-20s, well over 6 feet tall, thick-chested, and seemingly capable of throwing people around. Glasses were filled, cheese sliced, prosciutto attacked with a vengeance.
"When did you arrive?" Paolo asked, with only a trace of an accent.
This afternoon," Rick said.
"Are you excited?"
Rick managed to say,
"Sure,"
with some conviction. Excited about the next course. Excited about meeting Italian cheerleaders. Sam explained that Paolo had a degree from Texas A&M and worked for his family's company, one that made small tractors and farm implements.
"So you're an Aggie," Rick said.
"Yes," Paolo said proudly. "I love Texas. That's where I found football."
Giorgio just smiled as he ate and listened to the conversation. Sam said that he was studying English, then whispered that looks were deceiving because Giorgio couldn't block a doorway.
Great.
Carlo was back, directing waiters and rearranging the table. Nino produced another bottle, which, surprisingly, came from just around the corner. It was a Lambrusco, a sparkling red, and Nino knew the winemaker. "There are many fine Lambruscos throughout Emilia-Romagna," he explained, "but this was the best." And the perfect complement to the tortellini in brodo that his brother was serving at the moment. Nino took a step back, and Carlo began a rapid recitation in Italian. Sam translated softly, but quickly. "This is tortellini in meat stock, a famous dish here. The little round pasta balls are stuffed with braised beef, prosciutto, and Parmigiano. The filling varies from town to town, but of course Parma has the best recipe. The pasta was handmade this afternoon by Carlo himself. Legend has it that the guy who created tortellini modeled it after the belly button of a beautiful naked woman. All sorts of such legends here involving food, wine, and sex. The broth is beef, garlic, butter, and a few other things." Rick's nose was a few inches above his bowl, inhaling the rich aromas.
Carlo took a bow, then added something with caution. Sam said, "He says these are small servings because more of the first course is on the way." Rick's first ever tortellini almost made him cry. Swimming in broth, the pasta and its filling jolted his senses and caused him to blurt, "This is the best thing I've ever tasted." Carlo smiled and began his retreat to the kitchen. Rick washed the first tortellini down with Lambrusco and attacked the others swimming in the deep bowl. Small servings? Paolo and Giorgio had gone silent and were deeply involved with their tortellini. Only Sam showed some restraint. Nino seated a young couple nearby, then rushed forth with the next bottle, a fabulous dry red Sangiovese from a vineyard near Bologna that he personally visited once a month to monitor the progress of the grapes.
"The next course is a little more heavy," he said, "so the wine needs to be more strong."
He uncorked it with a flare, sniffed the bottle, rolled his eyes in approval, then began pouring.
"We are in for a treat," he said
as he filled five glasses, giving himself a slightly more generous serving. Another toast, more of a curse, directed at the Bergamo Lions, and they tasted the wine. Rick had always been a beer man. This headlong dive into the world of Italian wines was bewildering, but also very tasty. One waiter was gathering the remains of the tortellini, while another whisked down fresh plates. Carlo marched from the kitchen with two waiters in tow and directed traffic.
"This is my favorite," Carlo began in English,
then switched to a friendlier tongue. "It's a stuffed pasta roll," Sam was saying as they gawked at the delicacy before them. "It is stuffed with veal, pork, chicken livers, sausage, ricotta cheese, and spinach, and layered with fresh pasta." Everyone but Rick said, "Grazie," and Carlo took another bow and disappeared. The restaurant was almost full and becoming noisy. Rick, while never missing a bite, was curious about the people around him. They seemed to be locals, enjoying a typical meal at the neighborhood cafe. Back home, food like this would cause a stampede. Here, they took it for granted.
"You get a lot of tourists here?" he asked.
"Not many," Sam said. "All the Americans go to Florence, Venice, and Rome. A few in the summer. More Europeans than anyone else."
"What's to see in Parma?" Rick asked.
The Parma section of his guidebook had been rather scant.
"The Panthers," Paolo said with a laugh.
Sam laughed too, then sipped his wine and thought for a moment. "It's a lovely little town of 150,000. Great food and wine, great people who work hard and live well. But it doesn't attract a lot of attention, and that's good. You agree, Paolo?"
"Yes. We do not want Parma to change."
Rick worked a mouthful and tried to isolate the veal, but it was impossible. The meats, cheese, and spinach blended together into one delicious taste. He was certainly no longer hungry, nor was he full. They had been there for an hour and a half, a very long dinner by his old standards, but just warming up in Parma. On cue from the other three, he began to eat slowly, very slowly. The Italians around him talked more than they ate, and a mild roar engulfed the trattoria. Dining was certainly about great food, but it was also a social event. Nino dropped by every few minutes with a quick, "Is good?" for Rick. "Great. Wonderful. Delicious. Unbelievable." For the second course, Carlo took a break from the pasta. The plates were covered, small portions still, with cotolette alla parmigiana, another famous dish from Parma and one of the chef's all-time favorites. "Veal cutlets, Parma style," Sam translated. "The veal cutlets are beaten with a small bat, then dipped in eggs, fried in a skillet, then baked in the oven with a mix of Parmigiano cheese and stock until the cheese melts. Carlo's wife's uncle raised the veal himself and delivered it this afternoon." As Carlo narrated and Sam interpreted, Nino was busy with the next wine, a dry red from the Parma region. Fresh glasses, even larger, were presented, and Nino swirled and sniffed and gulped. Another orgasmic roll of the eyes, and it was declared sensational. A very close friend made the wine, perhaps Nino's favorite of all. Sam whispered, "Parma is famous for its food, but not its wine." Rick sipped the wine and smiled at the veal, and vowed that he would, for the rest of the meal anyway, eat slower than the Italians. Sam watched him closely, certain that the culture shock was vanishing in a flood of food and wine.
"You eat like this often?"
Rick asked him. Not every day, but this is not unusual, Sam replied casually. This is typical food for Parma. Paolo and Giorgio were slicing their veal, and Rick slowly attacked his. The cutlets lasted half an hour, and when the plates were clean, they were removed with a flourish. A long pause followed as Nino and the waiters worked the other tables. Dessert was not an option, because Carlo had baked his special torta nera, or black pie, and because Nino had secured a very special wine for the occasion, a dry sparkling white from the province. He was saying that the black pie, created in Parma, was chocolate with almonds and coffee, and since it was so fresh from the oven, Carlo had added just a touch of vanilla ice cream on the side. Nino had a minute to spare, so he pulled up a chair and joined his teammates and coach for the final course, unless they were in the mood for some cheese and a digestif. They were not. The restaurant was still half full when Sam and Rick began offering their thanks and trying to say goodbye. Embraces, pats on backs, powerful handshakes, promises to come again, more welcomes to Parma, many thanks for the unforgettable dinner. The ritual took forever. Paolo and Giorgio decided to stay behind and have a bite of cheese and finish off the wine. I'm not driving, Sam said. We can walk. Your apartment is not far, and I'll catch a cab from there.
I gained 10 pounds, Rick said, pushing his stomach forward and following a step behind his coach. Welcome to Parma.
Chapter 7. The buzzer had the high-pitched whine of a cheap scooter with a missing exhaust pipe. It arrived in long bursts, and since Rick had never heard it before, he at first had no idea what it meant or where it was coming from. Things were foggy anyway. After the marathon at Montana's, he and Sam, for reasons that were not clear then or now, had stopped at a pub for a couple of beers. Rick vaguely remembered entering his apartment around midnight, but from then on, nothing. He was on his sofa, which was too short for a man his size to comfortably sleep on, and as he listened to the mysterious buzzer, he tried to remember why he had chosen the den instead of the bedroom. He could not recall a good reason.
All right, he yelled at the door when the knocking began. I'm coming.
He was barefoot, but wearing jeans and a t-shirt. He studied his brown toes for a long time and contemplated his spinning head. Another screech from the buzzer.
All right, he yelled again.
Unsteady, he walked to the door and yanked it open. He was met with a pleasant buongiorno from a short, stocky man with an enormous gray mustache and rumpled brown trench coat. Beside him was a smartly uniformed young policeman who nodded his greetings but said nothing.
Good morning, Rick said with as much respect as he could muster. Signor Dockery.
Yes?
I am police.
From somewhere deep in the trench coat he produced documentation, waved it under Rick's nose, then returned it to its hiding place with a move so casual the message was, don't ask any questions. It could have been a parking ticket or a receipt from the cleaners.
Signor Omo, Parma Police, he said through the mustache, though it barely moved.
Rick looked at Romo, then at the cop in the uniform, then back at Romo.
Okay, he managed to say. We have complaints. You must come with us.
Rick grimaced and tried to say something, but a thick wave of nausea rumbled down low, and he thought about bolting. It passed. His palms were sweaty, his knees rubbery.
Complaints? He said in disbelief. Yes.
Romo nodded gravely, as if he had already made up his mind and Rick was guilty of something far worse than whatever the complaint was.
Come with us.
To where?
Come with us. Now.
Complaints? The pub had been virtually empty last night, and he and Sam, to the best of his memory, had spoken to no one but the bartender. Over beers they had talked football and nothing else. Pleasant conversation. No cursing or fighting with the other drinkers. The walk through the old town to his apartment had been thoroughly uneventful. Perhaps the avalanche of pasta and wine had made him snore too loudly, but that couldn't be a crime, could it?
Who complained? Rick asked. The judge will explain. We must go. Please, your shoes.
Are you arresting me?
No, maybe later. Let's go. The judge is waiting.
For effect, Romo turned and rattled some serious Italian at the young cop, who managed to deepen his frown and shake his head as if things could not possibly be worse. They obviously weren't leaving without Signor Dockery. The nearest shoes were the maroon loafers, which he found in the kitchen, and as he put them on and looked for a jacket, he told himself it had to be a misunderstanding. He quickly brushed his teeth and tried to gargle away the layers of garlic and stale wine. One look in the small mirror was enough. He certainly looked guilty of something. Red puffy eyes, 3 days' growth, wild hair. He tousled his hair to no effect, then grabbed his wallet, U.S. cash, apartment key, and cell phone. Maybe he should call Sam. Romo and his assistant were waiting patiently in the hallway, both smoking, neither with handcuffs. They also seemed to lack any real desire to catch criminals. Romo had watched too many detective shows, and every movement was bored and rehearsed. He nodded down the hall and said,
"I follow."
He dropped the cigarette in a hall ashtray, then stuck both hands deep in the pockets of his trench coat. The cop in the uniform led the perpetrator away, and Romo protected from the rear. Down 3 flights, onto the sidewalk. It was almost 9 a.m., a bright spring day. Another cop was waiting by a well-dressed Fiat sedan, complete with an array of lights and the word Polizia painted in orange on every fender. The second cop was working on a cigarette and studying the rear ends of 2 ladies who had just passed him. He gave Rick a look of utter disregard, then took another puff.
"Let's walk," Romo said. "It's not far. You need air, I think."
"Indeed I do," Rick thought. He decided to cooperate, score some points with these guys, and help them discover the truth, whatever that was. Romo nodded down the street and walked beside Rick as they followed the first cop.
"Can I make a phone call?" Rick asked.
"Of course. A lawyer."
"No."
Sam's phone went straight to voicemail. Rick thought about Arnie, but little good that would do. Arnie had grown increasingly hard to catch by phone. And so they walked, along the Strada Farini, past the small shops with their doors and windows open, past the sidewalk cafes where people sat almost motionless with their newspapers and little espressos. Rick's head was clearing. His stomach had settled. One of those small, strong coffees might be welcome. Romo lit another cigarette, blew out a small cloud of smoke, then said,
"You like Parma?"
"I don't think so."
"No?"
"No. This is my first full day here, and I'm under arrest for something I did not do. Kind of hard to like the place."
"There's no arrest,"
Romo said as he lumbered heavily from side to side, as if both knees were about to fold. Every third or fourth step, his shoulder nudged Rick's right arm as he lurched again.
"Then what do you call it?" Rick asked.
"Our system is different here. No arrest."
"Oh, well, that certainly explains things." Rick bit his tongue and let it pass. Arguing would get him nowhere. He had done nothing wrong, and the truth would soon settle matters. This was not, after all, some third-world dictatorship where they randomly rounded up people for a few months of torture. This was Italy, part of Europe, the heart of Western civilization. Opera, the Vatican, the Renaissance, Da Vinci, Armani, Lamborghini. It was all right there in his guidebook. Rick had seen worse. His only prior arrest had been in college, during the spring of his freshman year, when he found himself a willing member of a drunken gang determined to crash an off-campus fraternity party. Fights and broken bones ensued. The police showed up in force. Several of the hooligans were subdued, handcuffed, knocked around by the cops, and finally thrown in the rear of a police wagon where they were poked a few times by nightsticks for good measure. At the jail, they slept on cold concrete floors in the drunk tank. 4 of those arrested were members of the Hawkeye football team, and their adventures through the legal system were sensationally reported by several newspapers. In addition to the humiliation, Rick got 30 days suspended, a fine of $400, a scathing tongue-lashing from his father, and the promise from his coach that another infraction, however minor, would cost him his scholarship and send him to either jail or junior college. Rick managed the next 5 years without so much as a speeding ticket. They changed streets and turned abruptly into a quiet cobblestoned alley. An officer in a different uniform stood benignly by an unmarked opening. Nods and quick words were exchanged, and Rick was led through the door, up a flight of faded marble steps to the second floor, and into a hallway that obviously housed government offices. The decor was drab. The walls needed paint. Portraits of long-forgotten civil servants hung in a sad row. Romo selected a harsh wooden bench and said,
"Please, have a seat."
Rick obeyed and tried Sam's number once more. Same voicemail. Romo disappeared into one of the offices. There was no name on the door, nothing to indicate where the accused was or whom he was about to see. There was certainly no courtroom nearby. None of the usual hustle and noise of frantic lawyers and worried families and cops bantering back and forth. A typewriter rattled in the distance. Desk phones rang and voices could be heard. The cop in the uniform drifted away and struck up a conversation with a young lady at a desk 40 feet down the hall. He soon forgot about Rick, who was quite alone and unwatched and could have nonchalantly disappeared. But why bother? 10 minutes passed, and the cop in the uniform finally left without saying a word. Romo was gone, too. The door opened, and a pleasant woman smiled and said,
"Mr. Dockery, yes, please."
She was offering him an entrance into the office. Rick walked inside. It was a crowded front room with two desks and two secretaries, both of whom were smiling at Rick as if they knew something he didn't. One in particular was very cute, and Rick instinctively tried to think of something to say. But what if she spoke no English?
"A moment, please,"
the first lady said, and Rick stood awkwardly as the other two pretended to return to work. Romo had evidently found the side door and was no doubt back on the street pestering someone else. Rick turned and noticed the large, dark, double wooden doors, and beside them was an impressive bronze plaque that announced the eminence of Giuseppe Lazzarino, Giudice. Rick walked closer, then even closer, then pointed to the word Giudice and asked, "What is this?"
"Judge,"
the first lady said. Both doors suddenly flew open, and Rick came face to face with the judge.
"Rick Dockery,"
he shouted, thrusting a right hand forward while grabbing a shoulder with his left, as though they had not seen each other in years. Indeed, they had not.
"I am Giuseppe Lazzarino, a panther. I am fullback."
He pumped and squeezed and flashed his large white teeth.
"Nice to meet you," Rick said, trying to inch backward.
"Welcome to Parma, my friend," Lazzarino said. "Please come in."
He was already pulling on Rick's right hand as he continued to shake it. Once inside the large office, he released Rick, closed both doors, and said again,
"Welcome."
"Thanks," Rick said, feeling slightly assaulted. "Are you a judge?"
"Call me Franco,"
he demanded, waving at a leather sofa in one corner. It was evident that Franco was too young to be a seasoned judge, and too old to be a useful fullback. His large round head was shaved slick. The only hair on his head was an odd thin patch on his chin. Mid-30s, like Nino, but over 6 feet tall, solid and fit. He fell into a chair, pulled it close to Rick on the sofa, and said,
"Yes, I am judge, but more importantly, I am fullback. Franco is my nickname. Franco is my hero."
Then Rick looked around and understood. Franco was everywhere. A life-size cutout of Franco Harris running the ball during a very muddy game. A photo of Franco and other Steelers holding a Super Bowl trophy triumphantly over their heads. A framed white jersey, number 32, apparently signed by the great man himself. A small Franco Harris doll with an oversized head on the judge's immense desk. And displayed prominently in the center of the ego wall, two large color photographs. One of Franco Harris in full Steeler game gear, minus the helmet, and the other of Franco the judge here, in a panther uniform, no helmet, and wearing number 32, and trying his best to imitate his hero.
"I love Franco Harris, the greatest Italian football player,"
Franco was saying, his eyes practically moist, his voice a bit gravelly.
"Just look at him."
He waved his hands triumphantly around the office, which was practically a shrine to Franco Harris.
"Franco was Italian?"
Rick asked slowly, though never a Steelers fan and too young to recall the glory days of Pittsburgh's dynasty. Rick was nonetheless a fair student of the game. He was certain that Franco Harris was a black guy who played at Penn State and then led the Steelers to a number of Super Bowls back in the 1970s. He was dominant, a pro bowler, and later inducted into the Hall of Fame. Every football fan knew Franco Harris.
"His mother was Italian. His father was an American soldier. You like the Steelers? I love the Steelers."
"Well, no, actually."
"Why haven't you played for the Steelers?"
"They haven't called yet."
Franco was on the edge of his seat, hyper with the presence of his new quarterback.
Let's have coffee, he said, jumping to his feet, and before Rick could answer, he was at the door, barking instructions to one of the girls.
He was stylish. Snug black suit, long pointed Italian loafers, size 14 at least.
We really want the Super Bowl trophy here in Parma, he said as he grabbed something from his desk. Look.
He pointed the remote control to a flat-screen TV in a corner, and suddenly there was more Franco, pounding through the line as tacklers bounced off, leaping over the pile for a touchdown, stiff-arming a Cleveland Brown,
yes,
and ripping off another touchdown, taking a handoff from Bradshaw and bowling over two massive linemen. It was Franco's greatest hits, long, punishing runs that were enjoyable to watch. The judge, thoroughly mesmerized, jerked and cut and pumped his fists with each great move.
How many times has he seen this? Rick asked himself.
The last play was the most famous. The immaculate reception. Franco's inadvertent catch of a deflected pass and his miracle gallop to the end zone in a 1972 playoff game against Oakland. The play had created more debate, review, analysis, and fights than any in the history of the NFL, and the judge had memorized every frame. The secretary arrived with the coffee, and Rick managed a bad
grazie.
Then it was back to the video. Part two was interesting, but also a bit depressing. Franco the judge had added his own greatest hits, a few sluggish runs through and around linemen and linebackers even slower than himself. He beamed at Rick as they watched the Panthers in action, Rick's first glimpse of his future.
You like?
Franco asked.
Nice, Rick said,
a word that seemed to satisfy many inquiries in Parma. The final play was a screen pass that Franco took from an emaciated quarterback. He tucked the ball into his gut, bent over like an infantryman, and began looking for the first defender to hit. A couple bounced off, Franco spun free, kicked up his legs, and was off to the races. Two cornerbacks made half-hearted attempts to stick their helmets into his churning legs, but they bounced off like flies. Franco was soaring down the sideline, straining mightily in his best Franco Harris imitation.
Is this in slow motion?
Rick asked, a half-effort at humor. Franco's mouth fell open. He was wounded.
Just kidding, Rick said quickly. A joke.
Franco managed to fake a laugh. As he crossed the goal line, he spiked the ball, and the screen went blank.
For 7 years, I play fullback,
Franco said as he resumed his perch on the edge of his seat.
And we never beat Bergamo. This year, with our great quarterback, we will win the Super Bowl. Yes?
Of course. So, where did you learn football?
Some friends.
They both took a sip of coffee and waited through an awkward pause.
What kind of judge are you?
Rick finally asked. Franco rubbed his chin and considered this at great length as though he'd never before thought about what he did.
I do lots of things, he finally said with a smile.
His phone rang on the desk, and though he didn't answer it, he did look at his watch.
We are so glad to have you here in Parma, my friend Rick, my quarterback.
Thanks.
I will see you at practice tonight.
Of course.
Franco was on his feet now, his other duties calling him. Rick was not exactly expecting to be fined or otherwise punished, but Romo's complaints needed to be addressed, didn't they? Evidently not. Franco swept Rick from his office with the mandatory embraces and handshakes and promises to help in any way, and Rick was soon in the hall, then down the stairs and into the alley, all alone, a free man. Chapter 8. Sam passed the time in the empty cafe with the Panther playbook, a thick binder with 1,000 X's and O's, 100 offensive plays, and 12 defensive schemes. Thick, but not nearly as thick as the ones handed out by college teams, and a mere memo compared with the tomes used in the NFL. And too thick, according to the Italians. It was often mumbled in the tedium of a long chalkboard session that there was little wonder soccer was so popular throughout the rest of the world. It was so easy to learn, to play, and to understand. And these are just the basics, Sam was always tempted to say. Rick arrived promptly at 11:30, and the cafe was still empty. Only a couple of Americans would arrange a lunch at such an odd hour. Lunch, but only salads and water. Rick had showered and shaved and looked far less criminal. With great animation, he relayed the story of his encounter with Detective Romo,
his non-arrest, and the meeting with Judge Franco. Sam was highly entertained and assured Rick that no other American had received such a special welcome from Franco. Sam had seen the video. Yes, Franco was as slow in the flesh as he was on the film, but he was a punishing blocker and would run through a brick wall, or at least give it his best shot. Sam explained that, to the best of his limited knowledge, Italian judges are different from their American counterparts. Franco had broad authority to initiate investigations and proceedings, and he also presided over trials. After a 30-second summary of Italian law, Sam had exhausted his knowledge on the subject, and it was back to football. They picked through the lettuce and played with the tomatoes, but neither had much of an appetite. After an hour, they left on foot to handle some business. The first item was the opening of a checking account. Sam chose his bank, primarily because a certain assistant manager could thrash through enough English to resolve matters. Sam pressed Rick to do it himself, and helped only when things were at an impasse. It took an hour, and Rick was frustrated and more than a little intimidated. Sam would not always be around to translate. With a quick tour of Rick's neighborhood in the center of Parma, they found a small grocery with fruits and vegetables stacked along the sidewalk. Sam was explaining that Italians prefer to buy their food fresh each day and avoid stockpiling groceries in cans and bottles. The butcher was next door to the fish market. Bakeries were on every corner. "The Kroger concept doesn't work over here," Sam said. "Housewives plan their day around shopping for fresh food." Rick gamely tagged along, somewhat engaged in the sightseeing, but not interested in the notion of cooking. Why bother? There were so many places to eat. The wine and cheese shop held little interest, at least until Rick spotted a very attractive young lady stocking reds. Sam pointed out two men's stores and again dropped rather pointed hints about ditching the Florida garb and upgrading to the local fashions. They also found a cleaner's, a bar with great cappuccino, a bookstore where every book was in Italian, and a pizzeria with a menu in four languages. Then it was time for the car. Somewhere in Signor Bruncardo's little empire, a well-used but clean and shiny Fiat Punto had become available, and for the next 5 months, it belonged to the quarterback. Rick walked around it, inspected it carefully without uttering a word, but couldn't help but think that at least four of them would fit into the SUV he'd been driving until 3 days ago. He folded himself into the driver's seat and inspected the dash. "It'll do," he finally said to Sam, who was standing a few feet away on the sidewalk. He touched the stick shift and realized it was not rigid. It moved. Too much. Then his left foot got caught on something that was not a brake pedal. A clutch? "Manual, huh?" he said. "All cars here are manual. Not a problem, is it?" "Of course not." He could not remember the last time his left foot had depressed a clutch. A friend in high school had a Mazda with a stick shift, and Rick had practiced once or twice. That was at least 10 years ago. He jumped out, slammed the door, and almost said, "Got anything with an automatic?" But he didn't. He could not show concern with something as simple as a car with a clutch. "It's either this or a scooter," Sam said. "Give me the scooter," Rick wanted to say. Sam left him there with the Fiat he was afraid to drive. They agreed to meet in a couple of hours in the locker room. The playbook had to be addressed as soon as possible. The Italians might not learn all the plays, but the quarterback was required to. Rick walked around the block, thinking of all the playbooks he'd suffered through in his nomadic career. Arnie would call with a new deal, Rick would take off to his newest team, terribly excited, a quick hello at the front office, quick tour of the stadium, locker room, and so on. Then all enthusiasm faded the instant some assistant coach marched in with the massive playbook and dropped it in front of him. "Memorize it by tomorrow," was always the command. "Sure, coach. 1,000 plays. No problem." How many playbooks? How many assistant coaches? How many teams? How many stops along the way in a frustrating career that had now led him to a small town in northern Italy? He drank a beer at a sidewalk cafe and couldn't shake the lonely feeling that this was not where he was supposed to be. He shuffled through the wine shop, terrified a clerk might ask him if there was anything in particular he needed. The cute girl stocking the reds was gone. And then he was back, staring at the 5-speed Fiat, clutch and all. He didn't even like the color, a deep copper he'd never seen. It was in a row of similar cars parked tightly together, less than a foot between bumpers, on a one-way street with a fair amount of traffic. Any effort to drive away would require him to ease forward and back at least a half dozen times as he inched the front wheels into the street. Perfect coordination of the clutch, stick, and accelerator would be essential. It would be a challenge in an automatic. Why did these people park so close together? The key was in his pocket. Maybe later. He walked to his apartment and took a nap. Rick changed quickly into the Panther practice uniform. Black shirt, silver shorts, white socks. Each player bought his own shoes, and Rick had hauled over three pairs of the game day Nikes the Browns had so freely dispensed. Most NFL players had shoe contracts. Rick had never been offered one. He was alone in the locker room, flipping through the playbook, when Sly Turner bounced in, all smiles and wearing a bright orange Denver Broncos sweatshirt. They introduced themselves, shook hands politely, and before long, Rick said, "You wearing that for a reason?" "Yep. Love my Broncos," Sly said, still smiling. "Grew up near Denver. Went to Colorado State." "That's nice. I hear I'm a popular guy in Denver." "We love you, man." "Always needed to be loved. Are we gonna be pals, Sly?" "Sure. Just give me the ball 20 times a game." "Done." Rick removed a shoe from his locker, slowly put it on his right foot, and began lacing it. "You get drafted?" "Seventh round by the Colts 4 years ago. Last player cut. 1 year in Canada, 2 years in arena ball." The smile was gone, and Sly was undressing. He looked much shorter than 5'8", but he was solid muscle. "And here last year, right?"
"Right. It ain't that bad. Kind of fun if you keep your sense of humor. The guys on the team are wonderful. If not for them, I'd never come back."
"Why are you here?"
"Same reason you're here. Too young to give up the dream. Plus, I got a wife and kid now, and I need the money."
"The money?"
"Sad, ain't it? A professional football player making $10,000 for 5 months' work. But, like I said, I ain't ready to quit."
He finally pulled off the orange sweatshirt and replaced it with a Panther practice jersey.
"Let's go loosen up," Rick said, and they left the locker room and walked onto the field. "My arm's pretty stiff," Rick said as he made a weak throw.
"You're lucky you're not crippled," Sly said.
"Thanks."
"What a hit. I was at my brother's yelling at the TV. Game was over. Then Maroon goes out with an injury. 11 minutes to go. Everything was hopeless. Then..."
Rick held the ball for a second.
"Sly, really, I'd rather not replay it, okay?"
"Sure. Sorry."
"Is your family here?"
Rick asked, quickly changing the subject.
"No, back in Denver. My wife's a nurse. Good job. She told me I got one more year of football, then the dream is over." "You got a wife?"
"No, not even close."
"You'll like it here."
"Tell me about it."
Rick walked back 5 yards and straightened his passes.
"Well, it's a very different culture. The women are beautiful, but much more reserved. It's a very chauvinistic society. The men don't marry until they're 30. They live at home with their mothers, who wait on them hand and foot, and when they get married, they expect their wives to do the same. The women are reluctant to get married. They need to work, so the women are having fewer kids. The birth rate here is declining rapidly."
"I wasn't exactly thinking about marriage and birth rates, Sly. I'm more curious about the nightlife, you know what I mean?"
"Yeah, lots of girls and pretty ones. But the language thing is a problem."
What about the cheerleaders?"
"What about them?"
"Are they cute? Easy? Available?"
"I wouldn't know. We don't have any."
Rick held the ball, froze, looked hard at his tailback.
"No cheerleaders?"
"Nope. But my agent..."
He stopped before he embarrassed himself. So his agent had promised something that couldn't happen. What else was new? Sly was laughing, a loud, infectious laugh that said, "Joke's on you, clown."
"You came over here for the cheerleaders?"
he said, high-pitched and mocking. Rick fired a bullet, which Sly easily caught with his fingertips, then kept laughing.
"Sounds like my agent. Tells the truth about half the time."
Rick finally laughed at himself as he backed up another 5 yards.
"What's the game like here?" he asked.
"Absolutely delightful, because they can't catch me. I averaged 200 yards a game last year. You'll have a great time if you can remember to throw to our players instead of the other team."
"Cheap shot."
Rick zipped another bullet. Again, it was easily caught by Sly, who in return lobbed it back. The unwritten rule held firm. never throw a hard pass to a quarterback. Jogging up from the locker room was the other Black Panther, Trey Colby, a tall, gangly kid, too skinny for football. He had an easy smile, and in less than a minute said to Rick, "Are you okay, man?"
"Doing well, thanks. I mean, the last time I saw you, you were on a stretcher and..."
"I'm fine, Trey. Let's talk about something else." Sly was enjoying the moment.
"He'd rather not talk about it. I've already tried," he said.
For an hour, they played catch and talked about players they knew back home. Chapter 9. The Italians were in a festive mood. For the first practice, they arrived early and loud. They bickered over who got which locker, complained about the wall decor, yelled at the equipment boy for a multitude of offenses, and vowed all manner of revenge against Bergamo. They continually insulted and ridiculed one another as they slowly changed into their practice shorts and jerseys. The locker room was cramped and rowdy and felt more like a fraternity house. Rick absorbed it all. There were about 40 of them, ranging from kids who looked like teenagers to a few aging warriors pushing 40. There were some solid bodies. In fact, most seemed to be in excellent shape. Sly said they lifted in the off-season and pushed each other in the weight room. But the contrasts were startling, and Rick, as much as he tried not to, couldn't avoid a few silent comparisons. First, with the exception of Sly and Trey, all faces were white. Every NFL team he'd visited along the way had been at least 70% black. Even at Iowa, hell, even in Canada, the teams were 50-50. And though there were some big boys in the room, there were no 300-pounders. The Browns had 8 players at 310 or more, and only 2 under 200. A few of the Panthers would stretch to hit 175. Trey said they were excited about their new quarterback, but cautious about approaching him. To help matters, Judge Franco assumed a position on Rick's right, and Nino took charge of the left. They made lengthy, even rambling introductions as the players took turns greeting Rick. Each little intro required at least 2 insults, often with Franco and Nino tag-teaming against their fellow Italian. Rick was embraced and gripped and fawned over until he was almost embarrassed. He was surprised by the amount of English used. Every Panther was learning the language at some level. Sly and Trey were close by, laughing at him but also reuniting with their old teammates. Both had already vowed that this would be their last year in Italy. Few Americans returned for a third season. Coach Russo called things to order and welcomed everyone back. His Italian was slow and thoughtful. The players were sprawled on the floor, on benches, in chairs, even in lockers. Though he kept trying not to, Rick couldn't help but flash back. He remembered the locker room at Davenport South High School. It was at least 4 times larger than the one he was now in.
"You understand this?" he whispered to Sly.
"Sure,"
he said with a grin.
"Then what's he saying?" "Says the team was unable to find a decent quarterback in the off-season, so we're screwed again."
"Quiet!"
Sam yelled at the Americans, and the Italians were amused.
"If you only knew," thought Rick.
He'd once seen a semi-famous NFL coach cut a rookie for chatting in a team meeting during camp. Cut him on the spot. Almost made him cry. Some of the most memorable tongue-lashings, dog-cussings, verbal bloodlettings Rick had seen in football had happened not in the heat of battle, but in the seemingly safe confines of the locker room.
"Mi dispiace,"
Sly said loudly, causing even more chuckles. Sam continued.
"What was that?"
Rick whispered.
"Means I'm sorry," Sly hissed with his jaws clenched. "Now will you shut up?"
Rick had mentioned to Sam earlier that he needed just a few words with the team. When Sam finished his welcoming remarks, he introduced Rick and handled the translation. Rick stood, nodded to his new teammates, and said,
"I'm very happy to be here, and looking forward to the season."
Sam threw up a hand. "Halt. Translation." The Italian smiled.
"I'd like to clear up one thing."
"Halt. More Italian."
"I've played in the NFL, but not very much, and I have never played in the Super Bowl."
Sam frowned and rendered. He would explain later that the Italians take a dim view of modesty and self-deprecation.
"In fact, I've never started a game as a professional."
Another frown, slower Italian, and Rick wondered if Sam wasn't doctoring his little speech. There were no smiles among the Italians. Rick looked at Nino and continued.
"Just wanted to clear that up."
It is my goal to win my first Super Bowl here in Italy.
Sam's voice grew much stronger, and when he finished, the room erupted into applause.